Welcome to York Hospital Radio Meets, a podcast from York Hospital Radio. York Hospital
Radio. So, I've read a lot of football books over my life, particularly autobiographies. 95% of them tend to be the same, quite generic, quite predictable. But there's that 5% that are just kind of golden. And The Smell of Football is just a wonderful trilogy. And I'm delighted to have the author of those three books with us today. So, Mick, thank you so much for speaking to us on York Hospital Radio. I thought I'd start by giving sort of a bit of context to any listeners who aren't aware of your kind of career in football, particularly the beginning of it. So you were a very strong runner growing up, a talented footballer, you captained school teams in the Midlands, you're an England youth international, you came through the ranks, became a young professional at your boyhood club, Birmingham City, you were teammates with the like of Trevor Francis. From the outside looking in, life looked pretty, people would be very jealous of that kind of that life. But on the inside, you were kind of gripped by these crippling doubts, overwhelmed, and really what we'd probably class now as severe anxiety. So just talk me through that period. Have I got everything right there?
That's well explained. Yeah, it's really interesting because people on the outside looking in would think, wow, the perfect lifestyle. And they wouldn't understand that maybe somebody at that age would be so scared to play. And when I've thought about it, and trust me, I've thought about it about a million times over the last 50 years, it all goes back to watching the team when I was a schoolboy, when I was 11 and 12, even before then, midweek games, particularly me and my brother. And just the sheer noise and the sway of the crowd and the intimidating stuff and the booing essentially and all the abuse players got when they hit bad passes and that. And that, I guess, gave me some kind of I can say it now in 2026, can't I? Give me some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, I guess. And it affected me for the rest of my life. And the irony is, when I was there my first year at Birmingham in 1975, I was progressing fantastically well, England Youth International, absolutely one for the future. But I knew deep down that I wasn't really ready, didn't really want it, didn't want to go to being that person now on the pitch, getting all that noise and that abuse and the shouting at and that from the people in the stand where I once was. Notwithstanding the fact my brother will be there, my school friends will be there, and my next door neighbour will be there, and the chemistry teacher will be there. So it was a really difficult time for me, to be honest.
Because sometimes, you know, I feel like with supporters of any football club, they always want one of their own to come through, don't they, through the academy and get into the first team. But I think to some extent, the local lads maybe get a bit more scrutiny, maybe have that bit more pressure. Do you think you found that?
Well, you've read the Bible, haven't you? What does it say? A prophet's always hated in his homeland, is that it? So there is an element of that. They love to love, he's one of our own, but you're probably first to get the stick when things aren't going well as well. So I guess maybe a feeling of ownership. But, you know, look, now I've grown into a 67-year-old guy, I can look back and it is what it is. It's part of the game. I was at the Wrexham-Chelsea game last night and it's noisy and there's toing and froing and booing the ref and booing the players and booing the managers and booing everything and cheering everything. And I'm part of that. But I understand now it is of that moment and for that moment. And when you maybe, I don't do, but maybe you boo a player, you're not really hating on a personal level. You're just criticising that guy's on-field performance at that moment. But when you're young and 17, it's your hometown club, it's really difficult to kind of compartmentalise all that stuff.
And back then, I don't want to say that kind of mental health didn't exist. It, obviously, without a doubt, it did. But people maybe didn't label it as that. And certainly, it was a time where people were maybe told to man up. That was kind of like a phrase I remember kind of growing up. Do you think if you'd have played in the modern era, though you did say last night there was quite a lot of booing and stuff, do you think you might have been able to play at that sort of high level or had more of a chance of doing it?
I 100% think so. And like when I went back to Everton for the second time, 6 or 7 years ago, went for a month, stayed for 3 years the second time, Everton were absolutely fantastic at looking at that and looking at the profiles and the young lads. And even us in the medical team, just that simple question, are you okay? No, seriously, are you okay? You know what I mean? And that was very prevalent then. And it was a lot easier. It's not easy anyway, but it was easier in those terms. So moving on 50 years, it very much so is now kind of taken care of. And I think now if you saw a player in your team, even in your youth team, who looked off it, brilliant in training, terrible in the matches, quiet, going into a bit of a shell, it'd be picked upon straight away and something would be done. if anything can be done in some circumstances, maybe it can't, but it certainly now is a big factor to be considered in anybody's on-field performance, just what's going on off the field psychologically.
Yeah, and a lot of the stories you kind of narrated in your first book, The Smell of Football, and your storytelling was, you know, presented some of the most challenging times in your life, almost like as a dark comedy. I think like the time you went to speak to Alf Ramsey. Was that a conscious decision to storytell it like that? Or was that just something that people said afterwards, oh, I found that really funny, and you're kind of like, well,
yeah,
I wasn't writing it like that.
Yeah, I wanted it to be entertaining. I wanted it to be self-deprecating. I felt I could get the message over and it would be very, very funny. And people come up to me and say, my God, your books, they're the funniest thing I've ever read in my life. And I'm taking that as a compliment. I wanted it to be, I didn't want it to be all dark and, you know, people like putting the book there thinking, oh my word. So when people are probably going through that journey early on in the first book particularly, and probably thinking, oh my God, poor devil, like, and sympathizing and feeling bad, I was kind of glad they were laughing at the same time as well, like, you know, because, you know, we've all moved on since and I've survived to tell the tale, haven't I?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Merit Marks, I thought, was quite interested in the first book. Like, that seems to have died a little bit in recent times. I think there's not so much of it, but back then it was kind of like a bit of a public execution, wasn't it? Just one person's opinion, and they were saying 4 out of 10, 5 out of 10. Like, you wouldn't get that in any other kind of job or any other industry, I don't think.
No, but the thing was, back in them days, there was only one newspaper, the Sunday People. That was the almanac of getting your mark. And okay, I know that a guy sat in the stand can't judge 22 players and give them all accurate marks. So we know a lot of it's nonsensical. But to the people who don't go to the game, you're being judged not only by the 30,000 St Andrews who think you're shit, but the people picking up the Sunday People, the million people in Birmingham who are seeing your 5 and thinking he's shit. So it was a kind of that. But what happened was, later on, other newspapers started doing it, and then everybody was doing it, and then now on the websites, it's everywhere now. So you could now, I've had this myself. I've had a 5 in the Sunday People, yet an 8 in the News of the World for the same performance. And people started picking that up and realising then that it was nonsensical. So it kind of watered down all those horrors that I went through. Because as you said, back in them days, the only mark in town was the Sunday People. And even people that didn't go at the game, if you got a 5, you weren't playing very well.
So if you were getting an 8 in one and a 5 in another, were you calculating an average or were you focusing on the 5? What was your kind of psyche back then?
I was ripping up the paper with the 5 in and just putting the one with the 8 in next to my pillow at night. So there's an element to that. And I always say about the marks, I always say, you know, I got 10 once. Did you know that I got 10 once? Yeah. A Carling Cup game it was. 5 in the first leg, 5 in the second leg. So there's a little joke about it. But undoubtedly, as more newspapers started giving you marks, there was this anomaly and people saw it for the nonsense it obviously was. So it kind of watered down the effects.
And thankfully, you stuck it out with football. You moved on to Blackburn Rovers, where you played over 300 times across 9 seasons. Was it a case of those barriers you experienced at Birmingham were just kind of lifted? And was it also, I think you got the persona of kind of Baz, the nickname from, was it Basil Rathbone? And kind of that sort of
famous stuff. Actor, yeah.
Was that all kind of like part of just everything being erased from Birmingham City and almost starting afresh?
Yeah, it was a combination of things. First off, it was a geographical separation of 120 miles. So the chemistry teacher, my next door neighbour and my friends and my brother and everybody from school weren't watching anymore. There was nothing on the telly in those days. And I've dropped down a division to League Two in them days. It's called the Championship nowadays. So I've dropped down a bit. And back to that theme of a prophet's always hating his own town. When I went into Blackburn, it was kind of a big deal. England Youth International played in the first team at 17 in the top division. So I kind of went in, not under the door like I did every day to St Andrews, but I went in a kind of almost with a bit of a name. And I felt that on day one and it made me feel fantastic. And then a guy called Alan Birchinall, who took me in on the very first day, he's 80 now, Alan. He does the time before all the Leicester games. You must have seen him. You must have heard of him. He's a famous guy. And he just took me in and he gave me that name. He goes, that's Mick Rathbone. We'll call him Basil, after the actor, as you said, from the 20s. And you know what? It was incredible, that nickname, and it stuck. And most people wouldn't even know my name's Mick or Michael. It's really interesting. Everyone knows me as Baz. And I think I say in the book, funnily enough, on that day, March, whatever it was, 1979, that kind of pathetic wimp Mick Rathbone died, and this new guy, Bass, who actually wanted the ball, was born. And that was it. And you know the funny thing, my very first game 3 days after signing on loan, March 79, was Wrexham away. And now I go to all the Wrexham games, and I was there last night. And every time I go to a home game, I sit in my seat with my wife and I think, gosh, 50 years ago, me down there on the same pitch as my son now, me with my massive perm and big moustache.
Times have changed. And you had a long playing career as well, didn't you? And lots of different teammates. So did you ever see over the years other people kind of struggling with nerves or anxiety like you did, or was it still quite hidden?
It was very much hidden. And interesting, when the book came out, there were a couple of reactions. First, there were a lot of people contacted me and said, I was the same. A very, very famous, world-famous surgeon who I'd become friends with, he's based in London, he phoned me one day, he says, Baz, he said, I've just read your book. He said, that was me when I was 15. I was a bowler. I got in the Surrey Colts team. But when there was a crowd there, I couldn't let the ball go. So it touched everybody. So that was one reaction. And reaction number two was, not you, Baz. You're always laughing and joking. You were the epitome of confidence. So there was that. And I would always say, now I do talks on it sometimes, and I would always say to coaches, it's not always the guy crying in the corner, biting his nails and shaking. Sometimes it is the guy who's a little bit too loud, a little bit too confident maybe. So look, I'm sure it affects you in your life. I'm sure it affects most people. You don't have to be a high profile professional footballer to have no confidence. There are people who work in an office with three or four different girls and they have no confidence when they go in there. And there's people who work and maybe are the boss of 10 people who have to stand up and speak who have no confidence too. So unfortunately, the problem is not just related to sports people.
And after Blackburn, you went to Preston, where I think you suffered a fair bit with injuries. Did that make you interested in becoming a physio? Or was that at least you thinking about life after football?
No, I was really unlucky. When I played at Blackburn, apart from a broken leg, I played every game. So I played every game for 3 years. I was proud of my appearance record. And then when I went to Preston, it is what it is. It's just bad luck. I broke my arm and I ruptured my medial ligament, operation on my knee, blah, blah, blah. All things that just people were injuring me. So it wasn't me breaking down or being weak and that. But no, I had no... When I was at school, I went to a grammar school in Birmingham. I wanted to be a doctor. But obviously I left at 16, despite having the highest academic marks at the whole school. I left at 16. So then full circle, you're now 32, 33, couple of bots on your knee, on the AstroTurf at Preston, very unforgiving. You're just about grinding to the end of your career. Whoops. I've got no further education. I've got no savings. But what I have got is two young daughters, my wife, and a large mortgage. You're in trouble, mate, big time. Cue an incredible stroke of luck. The PFA had decided if they could train ex-professional footballers to be chartered physios, then they would have the best of both worlds. And that first cohort came out that very, very summer. And they asked me to go on. They let us off with having, I think I have 7 or 8 O-levels. They're not even called that now. So you have to be academic, but they did understand that nobody's got any A-levels because you all left school at 16. So I went on there with 7 other people. Nigel Adkins will be one of them, but they all became physio. So I went on that. And that was tough. The learning wasn't tough. The learning was easy enough, but the commitment was incredible because it was Tuesdays 1 till 8 at night, Thursdays 1 till 8 at night at Salford University, loads of work in between at home, and the worst of it, or the best of it, whichever way I look at it, as soon as the season finished, I was a physio at Halifax at the time, as soon as that season finished, last game, you're going into hospital for 8 weeks to do your clinical placement. So for me and my wife, kids for 4 years, no holidays, nothing like that. So it was one hell of a tough grind.
Yeah, and I can imagine the transition from being a footballer was probably difficult as well, because you'll have had, you know, you'll have been training in the morning and then have a rest of the time of your own, and then you're going from that to the other extreme, aren't you, with long hours.
Yeah, and especially back then. Now, if you work at a football club now, So my lad's obviously at Wrexham, so he'll go in tomorrow at 9 o'clock for breakfast, and then they'll get ready and have whatever they need, soft tissue, pre-activation, extended warm-up, probably go out on the grass about 11 o'clock, train, come back in, have lunch, and maybe do gym or recovery, whatever. It is more of a full day. But back in them days in the 80s, because we had no equipment and there was no kind of sports science understanding or anything like that, literally, I needed to be at Ewood Park at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I get there at a minute to 10. Me and the other team players, we get in the dressing room, get changed, jump in our cars, drive to the big country park, Winton Park, just down the way, train for 1 hour, 1 hour and a half, get back in our cars, go back to the ground, have a shower, and go home. There was no gym work because there was no gym. There was no food, there was no nutrition. Hungry, buy yourself some food. Why should we supply food? It was a different era. So inadvertently, the days were really short. But I'll tell you this, interestingly, I thought it was better because you were fresh all the time, and not just physically fresh, you were fresh from the day-to-day grind of being at that club all day long, and we've got a game Saturday and we're travelling on whenever, like, you know. So nowadays, the players are at the club much, much longer every day, and I don't necessarily think that's such a good thing, because I think you become stale. And I think in my day, 12 o'clock, I'm done. I'm in the park with my German Shepherd dog or in the snooker hall, relax, get away from it. So it's changed for the better in terms of the pure science of it all, but psychologically, I would say not for the better.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'll come on to some of those kind of like what's better, the old style or the new style later on. I mean, in terms that you mentioned there about kind of the long hours, I noticed, I think it was in the first book where you were sort of talking about when you were first at Preston as a physio and you were sort of playing in the reserves as well for them. So they were getting their money's worth, weren't they? You were kind of leaving your bag at the side. So I kind of wondered what happened if you got a knock. It was sent to you.
I never did, but that was the nature of it, and it was 7 days a week, and I had 2 weeks off in June, and that's 14 days. Let's do the maths. So I worked the other 351 days of the year, every Sunday, every Christmas Day, every Easter Friday, Good Friday, Easter Sunday, Palm Sunday, whatever they're called. Everything I worked, and Moisey did too. He was alongside me, and that was the physio's world. And you know what? I loved every minute of it. I couldn't get enough of it. And like, for example, you talked about that workload. I remember once getting back from Gillingham, I think, after a Tuesday night game. So that's got to be 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the morning. Going home, getting back in at 9, going out, doing all the running with the injured players. Then at lunchtime, getting the minibus keys, packing all the gear, driving the minibus up to Roker Park, which, as people probably don't know, is Sunderland's ground, prepping all the players, putting the strappings on, doing all the rubs, put my own boots on, playing a full 90 minutes, getting on the bus, driving it back. And that was the way it was. But as I say, everyone accepted that was the job of the physio. If you don't want to do the hours, don't be a physio at a football club. It's different now. There's a couple of physios with each team now. I would say a progressive club like Wrexham has maybe three or four medical staff with the first team. So it allows you to give people more time off. And when I first went to Everton, I had my own staff. I found it really, I didn't take, David would say to me, "Baz, have a day off." But I didn't want a day off because I was the boss and I didn't want to not be at the place. And I loved it so much in that. But as I got older, I realised that, you know, why should people work 7 days a week? And now at most clubs, the physio will work. You pop in for an hour Sunday if there's a Tuesday game, but most physios now will be off Sunday, in Monday, Tuesday. If they weren't too busy, probably everybody off Wednesday. That's modern living. They're probably the rules of the country now anyway. And it's a much more healthier approach, isn't it?
Absolutely. And how did you kind of watch the game as a physio? Because do you follow the ball? Are you looking for something else? Are you looking at, you know, there's 11 players out there that ultimately are responsible for, I suppose, in terms of their kind of like health. That must have been quite difficult for you as well, because you're used to being a footballer, a professional footballer. So you would have your own eyes of what that looks like to then be a physio. Must be totally different.
There was obviously a transition, but I don't recollect it being a massive conscious thing. As you said, as a physio, you're watching the game 2 seconds after everybody else. So when that ball's cleared and they're looking that way, I'm still looking that way to make sure he's got up, and then I'll look that way. So you do that. And I pride myself that I don't miss stuff. I see a lot of physios nowadays chatting, eating energy bars, which drives me crazy. And then you see a player on the floor. So even though it's not that often to run onto a serious injury, the potential is there. So I always concentrate on the game and I watch it close and I make sure I'm not that physio chatting away and somebody has to tap me on the shoulder and say, Baz, there's an injury, somebody's gone off the pitch at the far end. So I do concentrate, I take it really seriously.
And what about kind of like the pressure of being a physio? Because I was thinking about your career. Like, I think you were at Everton when Rooney came back from England with the metatarsal injury, which were really common around that time. So you're kind of responsible for probably the most famous foot in England at that point. And also, you know, when people sign players, when clubs sign players, it's almost like subject to a medical. And you, as a supporter, I'm almost thinking, well, that's a formality. But there's clearly going to be times where it's not a formality and you're putting people through their paces and thinking, oh, something's not quite right here. So what was that pressure like being a physio at that time?
It's very, very intense. But when you've been in it and lived in it, you don't really notice it till you step back outside. That night Wayne broke his foot, we were watching the game, and Moisey phoned me. He found out before me. He goes, Baz, I've heard he's broke his metatarsal. And then Gary Loon was the physio. He phoned me about half an hour later and says, Baz, he's done his metatarsal, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to be honest with you, the blood kind of drained from me because I knew immediately that's quite a complex injury and they're prone to refracture. I know he's coming back in a few days' time to me and I've got that responsibility. And Wayne, bless him, I saw him on the side of the pitch last night. Great fella, like, but difficult patient because he was so... I remember when we went to get his plaster taken off and I'm terrified that Wayne now... And the guy's taking his plaster off. So, right, I'm just going to go outside, Wayne, to phone the manager. Don't you dare get off that couch until we've got the boot on. You're like, you know, I go back, he's walking in bare feet to get himself a drink or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. And much as he's just such a fantastic, very, very humble guy, he was a difficult patient, but only difficult because he wanted to get back so quickly. And if I'm being totally honest, we'd done all the hard bit, you know, the x-ray every two weeks, we're getting there. Now he's on the bike, now he's swimming, now he's walking, now he's got his trainers on, now we're like jogging. He kept running off to fetch the balls. It was driving me mad. I was panicking. And we're now getting to the stage where he's got to put his boots on now. We're about 8 weeks post-fracture. We're still probably, I bet the season hasn't started because he did it in June, didn't he? We're now ready to go to the next level. And I'm starting to think, God, if this breaks again, I'm finished. Even though it wouldn't really be my fault, but it would be my fault. And we're ready to go into that phase now of boots on, running quick in a straight line. And of course, a little bit of twisting and turning and ball work. And then Man United came in for him. And I was thinking, oh, thank God. Thank God. And the day he went to sign, it was really interesting. I was at Everton's old training ground and I was sat in my office watching this big telly on the wall, thinking, please go through, please go through, please go through, please go through, please go through. And it went on for ages and ages and ages. And I'm thinking, there's a problem with his foot, problem with his foot. They're not going to sign, because he wasn't fit. He was only just jogging with me. They're not going to sign it. Oh no, he's going to come back here tomorrow. I'm going to have to do twisting and turning with that foot. And then about 4 o'clock, the Sky Sports news came on and there's a picture of Wayne holding a Man U scarf. So I was, oh, thank God.
Because Wayne had often like play football in the streets with the kids as well, wouldn't he, when he was younger, even when he had a pro contract with Everton. So it must have, I can imagine that being a really difficult time for you. So just going back to my second part of the question then, with medicals then, are they formalities?
No. What I do personally, I look at their most recent playing record. I don't care what the player costs. If the answer to the question, are you currently fit and free from injury and have been for the last 3 months, if the answer to that question is yes, essentially, barring a million to one chance of having a cardiac issue, you've passed your medical. I think Phil Neville talked about it once in an article he wrote when he came to Everton. He said, Baz just said to me, Phil, when was the last time you missed training? He said, oh, I've not missed a training session for a year. And I said, well, Phil, essentially, subject to the blood test and that, you've passed your test, you've passed your fitness test. And we were kind of laughing about it. But that is the truth of the matter. And I've done well over 100 medicals. And obviously, when you get to Everton, you're doing them back in them days for 10 million, 12 million, 15 million, Fellaini, 16 million euros, whatever it was, can't remember exactly. And then obviously the pressure's ramped up. But the question's still the same. And if Fellaini at 16 million or 40 million euros hasn't missed a game for 12 months, then that's the same as a free transfer. The last club I worked at was Harrogate for a month last October, and the question's the same. And obviously, if they're playing international football, they've had the heart screened probably every year. At clubs now, they have the heart screened every year. So you know if they're currently playing, they must have passed numerous heart tests and blood tests and that. So really, the fact they're currently playing at a high level every week and not missed a game for a year, that's it. If you keep looking, you will always find something. So I was very wary of the answer to that question. I've not missed a training session for months. Are you fit to train today? Yes. Can you play tomorrow? Yeah, of course. When was the last time you played? Last Saturday. And you're completely okay. Yeah. Essentially, you've passed your test. And if you start looking and scanning and x-raying and that, you know, just be careful what you wish for, because you're always going to find something wrong, isn't it? You know, it's like if I go for a wellness test tomorrow, I'll go in there a superhumanly fit 67-year-old, and I'll come out probably with a walking stick as an old man, because I'll have A and B and C, and do you know your level is that, and your level is that, and there's a bit of this and a bit of that. So there is an element to that too. I've done over 100 medicals. I've failed 3 players. When you fail a player, my God, the SHIT, absolutely, it's a fam. And their agent is saying you're an amateur, and their club is saying you're an amateur and you're a disgrace and what the hell's going on. Often your own manager is saying, what the hell's going on? But I always stood firm. And there was one occasion where a player, I won't mention his name, I said, no, I'm sorry, we're not going to take this player. He went back to his club, played against us, played fantastic. And the manager was on my case. You made a mistake. And I said, well, if I have, it's for the right reason. I don't believe I have. The player then went on 6 months later to have major problems with that joint and virtually had to pack in the game. So the 3 that I failed were for the right reasons. And as I say in book one, you know, it's Everton's money and I treat it like it's my money, but I'm not taking chances. I'm going to be the, you know, I'm not working for the manager. I'm not working for that player's agent. I'm working for Everton Football Club when I was at Everton, and I'm going to be the guardian of their purse strings and doing things the right way. And if people don't like it, the agents and the players and their club are going mad and that, I can't do anything about that. So I think I failed 3 players and they all went on to have significant problems. So I believe that's a 100% record.
And after Everton, you had roles with the likes of Manchester United, England at youth level, and Montserrat as well, which I imagine was an incredible experience. But your latest book, The Smell of Football Free, centres on the 100 days in the job as a physio at Accrington Stanley. And one thing that struck me was just your passion. So it doesn't matter whether it's England, Man United, Everton, Accrington, you just seem as proud just to wear the badge, because all clubs have got history and you're part of that history, no matter how big or small it is.
Look, I've had MR on an Everton shirt, I've had MR on a Man U shirt, I've had MR on an England shirt, and I've had MR on an Accrington shirt, and a Harrogate shirt, and an Oldham shirt, and I'm losing count now, a Dundee shirt, and a Blackpool shirt, and gosh, so many clubs I can't even remember, Crawley shirt, and I'm just as proud. So when I go on the way home from Accrington and stop at Starbucks, which I do most days, I don't go in the boot of my car and slip my Man United top with MR on. I proudly go with my Accrington Stanley top. And at the end of the day, and it may be because things were so tough for me when I was a young player, every player I deal with, and gosh, it's been thousands now, I often say to a player when we're out doing the rehab, I say, listen, you know, the player's happy, he's trained well. I say, mate, you've done really well today. You're definitely in my top 1,000 players I've worked with, definitely. But I treat all the players like they're my own son. So it may be a young 16, 17-year-old at Harrogate Town, League Two, small club, small crowd. But his issue is important to me as Wayne Rooney's was. There's no external pressure, but that could be my son. When my son was a young lad at Man United, they treated him like he was Wayne Rooney. They treated him fantastically well. And when he went to Rochdale and Rotherham, they treated him fantastically well. And it's not always like that, unfortunately. But every club I go to, whoever it is, they get the same treatment. I don't say to the young lad, and I've had it said to me, pee off, piss off, go on, come back in 2 hours, Tom. I've got senior players. I don't play favourites, you know, they treat them the same. And if he's 16 or 17 or 18 and he's going to get released in 2 weeks' time, if he needs a scan and a trip to see a consultant, he's getting that. So I've always proudly done that and treated everybody the same.
Yeah, I mean, it comes across so clearly, like how much you care and how deep that care is. I mean, you're right about you're not sleeping because you're worrying about the goalkeeper's thumb, or when there's a player kind of throughout the book. I think you refer to him as Jay, who there's a bit of a mystery around his illness and his injury, and that's really, you can tell it's really bothering you because you really care about it. But you can imagine a lot of people who have been at the likes of Everton and Man United and England working at that level would maybe not have that level of care that you clearly have.
Well, I hope they would. And the ones I've worked with, the physio I work with, they would. They've been fantastic. The standards are very, very high at clubs of physio and care. That guy had the most unusual injury. We took him everywhere. We did everything. They looked inside his knee and every scan, every consultant. It was unbelievable. And in a kind of way, that was a double-edged thing because it made the thing he had much worse and virtually impossible to sort out. But by the same degree, it showed that I wasn't making mistakes. So it was kind of worrying, stroke reassuring at the same time. And the worst of it was, he was such a great kid. And he was probably, 22, 23. And he was charming and he was humble. And even though he was going through hell and we couldn't get to the bottom of it, nobody could. So it was setback after setback. He never threw his toys. He never shouted at us. He was always tough. He'd walk away, probably in tears and that. And he was a joy to work with, kind of an oxymoron that. And he bought all my books, which is by far the most important thing. Obviously, book three weren't out then. But I contacted him afterwards and asked him if I could use him. And he was pleased to do so. He's now back in Australia. Eventually, you know, as Sherlock Holmes famously said, take away the things you know to be impossible, and what you have left is a solution, no matter how improbable. So by the time they'd exhausted everything that could possibly be wrong with a human being's knee, they came up with this incredibly rare thing, which it was. And they took steps and they've made his knee a lot, but he's had more surgeries than that. And when I last was in contact with him, he was doing okay. Would he get back to professional standard? Maybe not. But at least it was understood what the hell had gone on. And it was so rare. It was unbelievable. Most of the none of the surgeons had ever heard of it. It was so vanishingly rare. Like,
you know, you've worked at the bottom end of the pyramid, despite playing kind of a lot higher up. One thing that was kind of interesting was this idea about, like we were talking about earlier, really about kind of how the game has changed from when you were playing to now. And you were saying one sort of chapter in the book about how players are kind of expected to take responsibility on the pitch, but they have very little responsibility off it. And that was quite interesting sort of observation, really, for me.
It's really interesting because they are looked after, I'll put my words, they're looked after, everything's done for them. Sometimes even players will get the girl in the office or the man in the office to book their holiday flights or book a hotel room, or can you send my wife some flowers and that. Everything is done. You will be at the dinner at 7 o'clock. The meeting's at 7:30. We'll contact you at 7:15 to remind you that dinner's at 7 up tomorrow morning. Then we're going for a walk. Everyone's walking with the physio in this direction. It's very, 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 very controlled. There's very little ability to think for yourself or to kind of grow intellectually. You know, that's the way it is at every club, I'm sure, maybe not so much now. And then you get that classic at half time when you're 4-0 down, effing hell, can't any of you think for yourselves? Well, no, because since I was 8, you've been doing all these things for me. So unfortunately, I actually can't think for myself. And I see that a lot. And I don't know what it's like at the top clubs now. I see fantastic managers like the Chelsea manager last night. And I would think these top guys are now understanding that we need to make a much more rounded person who can think for themselves. And it was really interesting because when I worked for the England teams, we'd have loads and loads and loads and loads of meetings. We'd be away in Serbia or Estonia or Armenia. And there'd be a meeting at 9, training, back, lunch, meeting at 2. Swimming pool, walk, dinner, film, meeting at 9. Those meetings punctuated the whole day. And at first they were very, very passive. And a lot of people like myself were fighting to stay awake during the meetings. Like, I actually dozed off a couple of times. I'm not even joking. It was embarrassing, but it was funny. It was funny because everybody got up and went out. And I was, when I woke up, I was on my own in the meeting room. Then when Dan Ashworth came in and a guy called Dave Redding as performance director, they were much more forward thinking. And then the meetings were much more proactive. Now the players, I'm not necessarily saying liked it, but all of a sudden, right, four lads there with a pen and paper, four lads there, four lads there, four lads there, four lads on that table. Right, tomorrow we think we're going to be playing against a team who play with five at the back. How are we going to counter attack that? And they have to sit down, they have to actually think, put the phones down, and for the first time in their lives, instead of just being spoon-fed, so we need to get it widened, and then one player would have to stand up and say, right, blah, blah, blah. And the next question would be, what are we going to do if our midfield player, I don't know, goes off injured? And just to get players to think for themselves. And at first, it was quite hard for the players to go from this passive meeting to actually getting involved. But after a while, they became very good at it and relished it. And I think, I mean, the England teams are very strong at every level anyway. But it didn't do them any harm, that's for sure.
Yeah. And another thing that I really liked about the book was the insight into how the game's changed. Sort of small observations like the stadium changing rooms. A lot of these old style grounds, I imagine Akron and Stanley's kind of one of them. Those changing rooms were designed for 11 players to be in them rather than the large squads that everyone's got today. And, you know, they've probably got seven subs, haven't they, I think, even in the National League. So that was quite interesting that you were kind of right on that. I've never sort of thought about that before, but it's correct.
Well, Accrington's got new dressing rooms. They're fantastic. The ground at Accrington's fantastic, the facilities. But you're right. So we would go to Palace, Portsmouth in the Prem, Palace in the Prem. Fulham's the one where you get changed in the cottage. And it's tiny. And I've got my medical stuff in the bath with getting stuff out of there, like, you know, and players are moaning. And I would always say to the players, did you know that up until 1962, I think, there were no subs, none. There was only 11 players, no subs. So these dressing rooms, 100 years old, were built for 11 players and the trainer, who is now kind of the physio, to get changed. So back in the day of this dressing room, 12 people got changed. Now we've got 20 players, including the 9 subs now. The manager gets changed, the coach gets changed, the assistant coach, the free kicks coach, the doctor, the head physio, the performance. There's about 30 people getting changed. Sometimes, you know, when I'm sat waiting for a game to start like yesterday, I look down on the pitch and I counted over 80 people on that pitch. So about half an hour before the kickoff, when everyone's warming up, I think I lost count at about 80. And when it went to extra time and they're huddling together, there were so many Chelsea staff. I lost count at 30. Now, only 11 people played the game, but there were well over 30 people huddled around. Now, that's not a criticism. And in a way, it means people like me will never be out of a job. And there's more players at every club. So I guess it means my son will never be out of a job, because even players now in the National League are full-time. When I worked at the clubs in League Two, like Harrogate and Accrington, they had up to 30 players as well. And Salford, I've worked there 3 times. So in a way, all this kind of, I hesitate to use the word excess of everything, you know what I mean? It's giving everybody lots of work, isn't it? And I'm benefiting from it. My son's benefiting from it. So don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Another thing as well was like a lot of us as adults, I think, we get a minor illness and we sort of fear the worst. I think I've found that as I've got older. And I always assume footballers, because of how fit they have to be to sort of play, wouldn't be like that. But your sort of book suggests that quite a few players are kind of hypochondriacs, and, you know, they're wanting scans, and sometimes they weren't trusting your professional judgment, even though you've been in the game such a long time. It clearly wasn't like that in your playing days. You wouldn't have been able to turn around and say, well, I want a scan on that. Or, but no. Again, that was another interesting kind of insight, I thought.
Yeah, well, there were no scans. So you trusted the physio, and the physio says you can train with that, that's great. You never went in the physio's room unless you were injured. Now, most players will go in the medical room every day for some soft tissue work. I call it fluffing in book 3, don't I? And I've done more of that than anybody else in the world. So it's okay, it's decent, so it's not hurting anybody. When I played, I never saw a doctor at Birmingham. There weren't a doctor. But now at Everton and a lot of the clubs, and maybe Championship clubs as well, there's a full-time doctor there 7 days a week. So as in Parkinson's law, what would tend to happen is, right, the doctor's there, he's on tap, you're here, you've had your lunch and that. So next news, you're scratching your arm and you see a spot and I'm just going to see the doctors, make sure it's not skin cancer, and the doctor, and that, now tomorrow the doc's checking everybody's ears and that, because he's there, because he can. He may not have a massive workload, and now four players have got something wrong with their ears when they didn't really in the first place, and he needs to see a dermatologist when it's just a freckle. And all of a sudden, as in Parkinson's law, you create this mad rush for more medicalization. So there is an element of that.
Yeah. And one thing that book one and two, you know, there were some fantastic stories in there. Very, very funny, like I said earlier. What I really liked about book three was it was different. It was a little bit kind of like hearing like your inner kind of monologue, really, of what you're thinking. And, you know, you mentioned about dementia throughout that as well, which again was quite interesting. But also, like, I found myself kind of agreeing with your kind of football morals, as it were. You know, referees in particular, the role of the fourth official, I found myself kind of nodding along, because they are literally just there to be abused, aren't they? They hold a board up of how many minutes it is, but the rest of the game, they've just got the manager from opposing sides just berating them over every decision, even though he has got no kind of influence on that, really, or very little influence on any sort of decision on the pitch.
So I do a couple of days a month at Loughborough with the Premier League referee championship refs. I do the rehab when they're injured, so I know them all well. They're such good guys. They are so good at their jobs. And they're trying to be as good as they possibly can. But unfortunately, the bottom line is, if you give the free kick that way, he's going to say you're a disgrace. And if you give it that way, he's going to say you're a disgrace. And the penalty incident, he'll swear on his mother's grave that was never a pen, and he'll say it's the most clear pen. And with that backdrop, the referees can't win, they'll never win. And no matter how much they practice and try and study and that, they'll never win because of that insane bias. And the irony is, for the fourth official, he's not even involved in the decision making. So something happens like 60 metres away, and then, I don't know, one of the officials from one dugout screams at him, "What's effing else going on?" and that, like. And I'm sat there thinking, he never gave that decision. Why are you screaming at him? The ref gave that decision. And as I said before, like, nobody makes fewer mistakes than the referees. The players, international players, can give terrible passes, make terrible mistakes, score spectacular own goals, let players run, miskick the ball, slice the ball. And that's okay. But if a ref makes one decision that's not quite right, he's a disgrace. He shouldn't be at this level. And managers will say the most hurtful things. And I hope I live long enough to see one of the pundits who were always criticising the referees referee a game. I think they'd completely change their outlook. I've reffed a couple of games, and mate, after 5 minutes, your best friends are hating on you. It's impossible. So whatever you give, half the people are saying it's a disgrace. Yeah. And until we shift that mindset, the referees will never be able to progress and never be able to win.
And I just think, you know, we were talking earlier about mental health. I just think for someone to be there and just for 90 minutes just be getting abused, and even if it's, they know, you know, well, it's not my decision, and you can kind of brush it off. But if someone for 90 minutes, or two people for 90 minutes are constantly telling you things, it's just not nice to hear, is it? In this day and age, I think it's strange how it's allowed to happen.
I can't think of another sport where that's allowed to happen. I watch the Six Nations rugby, and I like the rugby. I enjoy it. It's good. And I think, oh, why can't football be like that? The referee, 5'8" tall, towering 6'10" players over him, he gives a decision. And if there's one word of back chat, it's taken on 10 yards. It's not allowed. It's unbelievable. Why? You know, you don't see in... I can't think of a sport where you see that stuff going on, only football. And it's a real shame, because I think it's spoiling it. And if you go over the park on Sunday morning and watch the under-8s game, you'll hear the moms and dads, some of them, I think it's getting better now, but still some of them screaming at the referee, who's probably like 13 years of age. And you think, mate, what are you doing? It's a game of football. And you know what? Even at professional level, it's a game of football. And there's a game on this afternoon, and somebody said it's a massive game. It really is a massive game. And I'm thinking, it'll be forgotten by tomorrow. And they are just games. And, you know, I know it's big business, but it's just a sport, and it can only... And then the game last night, Wrexham and Chelsea, the rubber, the green went to Chelsea because we got a red card, took us down to 10 men. I accept that the referees made that with VAR, and it was the right decision. Then we had a goal disallowed because it was half an inch offside. But those are the rules, and we take that on the chin. We didn't have the rubber, the green and that. But that game's gone, and we move on to the next game. I don't think it's healthy to be hating on the officials for that. And actually, they did everything right anyway. But there's been times in the last couple of years where officials have made mistakes, clearly made mistakes. And then, like, we're wanting him to come out and apologise. Well, is your centre-half going to apologise for giving that penalty away or putting it in his own net? Is your winger going to apologise for repeatedly crossing the ball out of play on the far side? So it makes me quite sad, the whole thing, to be perfectly honest. And especially now I work with the referees and that. You know, I don't want to be a cheerleader for them because I can look after themselves. But as I say, I can't think of any other sport.
Yeah. And the major theme in the book, or certainly how it goes towards the end, I'm not going to spoil the ending for anyone because I implore anyone to get the book, but this idea about players feigning injury to run the clock down, I mean, for a physio, that must be a nightmare. And you articulate that so well in your book. And, you know, because your job is the safety of those players. So a player goes down, your instinct is to check they're okay. But if you then go on the pitch, then that player has to go off the pitch. I mean, it's just an absolute minefield, isn't it?
Yeah, and it shouldn't come into my territory. My job is to run on the pitch when the referee calls me onto the pitch. End of. It's not to wait. It's not to don't you go on that pitch. Don't you go on the pitch. Don't you effing dare go on that pitch. That's not my job. And when you run onto a player who's just wink, wink, running the clock down, I think, come on, for God's sake, are you running the clock down? What, 30 seconds? You know what I mean? We've seen the goalies do it all the time, aren't we? And it's boorish, isn't it? And people have just about had enough of it, haven't they? Like, you know, so the goalkeeper sits down and what's going to happen next is the goalie will have to go off. And then when they're genuinely in, it's going to cause major problems. And you hear some of the pundits saying, this rule where they have to go off for 30 seconds, it's a joke. He's properly injured. That. Yeah, but the players have made it happen. The players have forced the hands of the officials by continually play acting. So again, the refs are getting blamed for that. And I think footballers a lot, they don't probably take a lot of responsibility for stuff. It's always kind of somebody else's fault in some cases. I was the worst defender, by the way, when I was a player.
Are you finding that, you know, you must obviously talk to other physios as well. Do you find that they're getting exasperated by it as well? That kind of they don't quite know when someone's injured and when someone's not? And do physios then, are they starting to play the game as well? It must be so difficult.
Well, it's impossible. I stuck to my guns in a way, and if I made it clear to all those concerned, if the referee calls me on, I'm going on. And they, yeah, but I'm not interested in that. When the referee calls me on medico-legally, I'm going onto the pitch. Yes, I'm employed by this particular club, they pay my wages, but my job is the care of those players. Now, if I run on and he's just wink, wink, wasting time, he has to go off for 30 seconds, they score because we've got 10 men, that's nothing to do with me. So, you know, for every kind of rule, the next move is to kind of circumvent the rule, isn't it? Like, you know what I mean? So I guess the pressure to win is so high, apparently, but to me, it's still a game. But that's where we're heading now, and everybody can gain a yard. And I say in my book, Gareth Southgate, who I've met on many occasions, is one of the nicest, best people you'll ever meet in your life. He's even said, you know what? On balance, if you can master the dark arts, any club that master them, you've probably got a slightly better chance of winning. And at the highest level, it's 1% either way and that. And you see it a lot, and, you know, you see players. Sometimes I'm screaming at the television when the Premier League games are on, for God's sake, get up, mate. And we've seen a couple of instances lately where it's been proven there was zero contact in the Premier League, and players are going and holding the face and that. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if the FA have to get involved or all this pushing and shoving at corners and throwing themselves down. I don't know whether the FA need to get involved, or maybe the PFA, the Players' Union, would get the captain from each club and say, listen, lads, the general public are getting really turned off football by this. It looks really bad. You know, we've paid hard-earned money. People are walking to take a corner after like 3 minutes of the game, wasting time as much as they possibly can. Slightest contact, writhing round. There was a player on the telly the other day, weren't there? He was rolling around on the floor like he had a broken leg. Then the ball came to him. He jumped up and just sprinted off with the ball. And it was funny, but it wasn't funny. It was poor, and you don't see it in other sports, do you? So I think we could do better with that, couldn't we? I think we, most decent football loving people, You know, we're appalled by that kind of stuff, aren't we? You know, players clutching the face when the slow motion shows there's no contact and that. It's not a good look, is it, for the sport? And then you kind of juxtapose it against watching the Six Nations, players' blood coming out of every orifice and just piling into tackles and that. And the contacts there are like 20 times that anything in the Premier League, where the players are rolling around on the floor and that. So I think football's got to just nip that in the bud, because a lot of football fans are getting absolutely ticked off with it all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my team, York City, I mean, the goalkeepers, you know, occasionally our own, but quite often the opposition, because we're kind of very high up in the league and teams are wanting to try to slow us down. And it tends to be all around the same time every week as well, about 25 minutes in, they just take a seat. And it's you know, everyone's frustrated by it. Did you find that when you were writing this sort of stuff in the book that it was, and I suppose the same with book one and two as well, that it's quite a therapeutic sort of process for yourself?
It was, and I wanted to be careful I wrote it, because I didn't want to criminalise the people I worked for, who were fantastic at their jobs and very, very good people and good to me. And I do say in my book, this is not about them per se, it's about the environment that has created this situation. And I say, probably in that guy's situation, I may well have done the same with all that pressure. So it was more of a criticism of the situation as well. I was very careful not to make it, look what he's done to me, look what they've done to me. So I think I did that okay, as best as I could. But I wasn't going to write anything. I was going to write maybe a diary of a season and that. And I weren't even that bothered. I just wrote a few notes every day. And I thought, would it be interesting? But then when that kind of last 10 days unfolded, I thought, well, right, I'm going back and I'm going to write a book about this. I think it'll be really interesting. And it's quite prophetic now, isn't it, that all this stuff's kind of come to the fore, that I kind of wrote about it like 6 months ago. Like it's all coming to fruition, and more so. And it's now being picked up by the pundits and the media and the general public, isn't it, that this kind of stuff's going on a bit now. You know, we have to sort of nip it in the bud.
It's a great read. And one thing as well that was quite interesting was about your initiations that you have to do when you join a club. And when I sort of think back to your book one, and you're just kind of really struggling with your anxiety and kind of the confidence and stuff, but you're there sort of, I think it's Eminem, isn't it, that you do at these clubs, and you've done it about six or seven times now, or maybe even more. It just sort of shows how you've kind of changed. I know it's a bit of a random example, but how you've kind of grown as a character and as a person, I suppose.
I guess that's a barometer. That's a measuring tool, isn't it? If they said to me when I was 16, 17, I went with the first team to Holland on tour, I was terrified of joining, terrified of everything. Like, if they had said to me, you need to get up and sing now, it didn't happen in those days, I couldn't have done it. And then as I got older and older and older, I went to about nine different clubs and just stand up and I say in my book, they're not judging you as a singer, like, just get up and sing, you're not a professional singer. And I actually started looking forward to doing it. It was my little party piece, because when you're 65, 66, 67, the last thing they're expecting is the final rap scene from 8 Mile. Let's be honest, everyone word perfect along with the physical actions.
Incredible. And, you know, just sort of lastly, really, I just wanted to mention, you mentioned that you were at Wrexham last night, because obviously watching your son, Ollie Rathbone, who's gone on to have a, you know, a fantastic career. You must be incredibly proud, and some former players, I would imagine, have quite pushy parents wanting them to sort of follow in their footsteps and stuff like that. But it really comes across that you and your wife simply want him just to enjoy playing without the shackles that maybe you had when you were kind of growing up. Is that the case?
100%. And that's probably from where I was and how it affected me as a young person. That, and knowing that the fallout rate in the under eight, under nines is like 99.5%. And Oliver's a really clever lad. So we said all along, just go to your football. He wanted to join Man United. They wanted to sign him. So he said, yeah, that's no problem. I was actually working there at the time when he was a young pro there. But we knew that you've got a 0.5% chance of making the grade. So we said to Oliver, look, we'll go. My wife will take you four times a week. And she did, loved it. It was a great academy. All they ever did was pick two teams and played football. They knew that Rashford and Scott McTominay were going to be something special. But they dragged the Ollies and the, you know, the Fosu Mensahs and the Two and Zabies and the Jack Addisons along as well. And they've all had good careers too. So it was a fantastic place. And we always said to Oliver, enjoy it. Just play it and enjoy it. And all we ever said to him, probably based on my experiences, just do your best and enjoy it. And if it takes you to Barcelona, we're proud of you. If it takes you to the Dog and Duck, we're proud of you. And I go to all the Wrexham games, and at the end of the game, he comes in the players' bar. And if he's been sub, not used, sub got on, man of the match, scored a goal, been whatever. I'm sat there with a pint of Wrexham lager, and Julie, my wife, is sat there with a cup of tea, and he comes in, and that's it. And if he's scored, I don't go high-fiving him and knee sliding over to him. And if he's not got on or been sore or not had a particularly good game, I don't say, oh, bloody hell, son. I've never, ever commented on his performance and that, like, you know, I just comment on his effort. Well, mate, do you want a drink? And that's it. And he knows that that constant, supportive, non-critical role has always been there. And I said the same to my daughters, just do your best and have a good life and that. And I think they're all really happy. And I guess they're all successful. Everyone measures success, but I measure success in just happiness and contentedness. So, yeah, I think my wife's done a great job with the kids.
And you just said there about your daughter knee slide over to him. But I think I interviewed Gary Swan, who used to play for York City and Preston. And he said you did do a lot of knee sliding on the old AstroTurf. And so maybe that's why you did pick up some injuries.
He was such a good player, Swanee. He was such a good player. If he'd have had a yard of pace more, he'd have played a lot higher up. He used to get in the box late and finish and that. And he was such a good guy as well, yeah. He's from York, isn't he, Swanee?
Yeah, he is, yeah. He finished his
Preston
career
Preston signed him from Hull. I think Preston got him from Hull, did they?
That's
many,
right, yeah.
Many years ago. Yeah, he was a good friend of mine. And he was a really good player, Swanee. God, I haven't seen him for years.
I'll send him your interview afterwards. And just very final question, you know, how do people get hold of the book? Because I got it by private messaging you and got signed copies like I did the second one, but the first one was in Waterstones. What's the best way for people to get the book?
So book three, The Smell of Football 3, is available the usual places, Waterstones, Amazon. I'm not sure if there's any left in the shops or if there's any, but they're online, Waterstones, Amazon. They're only 50 quid. Or if you contact me on Twitter at BitRathbone and send me 15 quid, I'll send you one signed to you.
Prize possession for me. Mick, Baz, so pleased to have you on. It's been an absolute delight. I've honestly loved reading the books over the years. And yeah, I really like your philosophy on life. And I think the other thing as well in the book about the burnt toast theory, I really struck a chord with me that things kind of happen for a reason. And you know, you're definitely an inspiration to people reading those books. And, you know, and thank you for doing them.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me on.
Pleasure.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please consider making a donation to our charity via Just Giving, justgiving.com/York Hospital Radio. You can also help us by subscribing and writing a review to help spread the word. Thank you for listening to York Hospital Radio Meets.
Your station, York Hospital Radio.